Welcome to the 41st episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Rye.
And I'm Terry Chow.
And as Shane Warne condemns Australia's rotation policy, welcome to the podcast that is still sticking with the same lineup.
And we've got another jam-packed episode. We're going to be looking at the highlights and the lowlights of the last couple of weeks. And on top of that, Andy's going to be taking us back to the hidden history of international 2020 cricket. We're going to be reviewing the excellent book Chinaman by Shehan Karunatilaka, and we're going to be debating whether England's women transgressed the spirit of cricket. So what's caught your eye recently?
Well, it's actually a place, a cricketing stadium, rather than a sort of cricketing event that's really caught my eye. These days, I find ODI series, even those involving England, are harder and harder to get passionate about. I mean, there's no context, and frankly, a couple of weeks later, I'd struggle to tell you who won. So the fifth ODI between England and India, which was also a dead rubber, wasn't the kind of game to instinctively attract my attention. But Dharamsala Cricket Ground must quickly take the title for being one of the most stunning and extraordinary settings where the game has ever been played. With the Himalayas rising behind it, it's astonishingly dramatic. And you've seen an awful lot of cricket grounds, both in international and domestic cricket, that are kind of pretty, that are quite twee, that are quite nice, even some that are quite grand. I've just never seen anything that is quite this bold and extraordinary.
I wonder whether when they... Because this was the first international game, wasn't it, at the ground. Whether when they pick grounds, whether they actually have in mind the sort of aesthetic feature of the ground, which, I mean, you think that's somehow...
You should do all this, shouldn't you?
Old Trafford, not the prettiest location of any ground in the world. It's a nice...
I think part of the Indian board logic was taking it to a place where cricket hadn't been before, and the one drawback of it is it's very cold there.
Because you're in the Himalayas, which in turn makes it look beautiful.
Quite. And Virat Kohli, rather unhelpfully, announced about a week before the game. He was like, I don't know if we're actually going to play there. He was like, I think it's probably too cold there. But they did play there, and it was just an extraordinary
setting. But this could be the new secret weapon of the Indians. If they have to come over and sort of play in an English May, they just go up there to warm up in some sleet for a couple of weeks.
And you also kind of feel like, well, actually, this is part of what we watch cricket for. You know, unlike a lot of sports, cricket grounds really do have a unique character.
I still remember fondly going to Arundel for the first time last summer, and there is certainly something about the experience, because cricket, the fact that it takes up a whole day, whether it's a one-day match or a five-day match, it's about the experience of going somewhere and spending a whole day.
Dharamsala is on our hit list. We're heading there. Now you've been more interested in events, well, slightly more niche events, Australian domestic cricket,
which is not something that I follow as often as I should. Since Ricky Ponting's retirement from international cricket, I'm a big fan of Ponting, and I've been really interested in the way that he's departed the game. Departed the game sounds a bit biblical,
like he's
doesn't
died
it?
As well, yeah.
But he's got a double century for Tasmania in the Sheffield Shield, and I thought this was a good thing for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because for the sake of Ponting, that he hasn't sort of just gone and died a cricketing death somewhere. And often you see players retire from international cricket and go and sort of scrape away a couple of seasons before, you know, realising that they really can't cut it in any form of decent sort of state or grade or county cricket. But also, I think it's a nice endorsement of the fact that whilst you've got international cricket going on, that there's still a tremendous standard of cricket to watch, and as much as anything for Australian state cricket, which, as I say, I don't follow ordinarily, it's quite nice to have this endorsement for the rest of the world of the game, these international superstars going back and playing.
I mean, I think the other point is these states, I guess in a very similar way to how counties in England do, they stick by these players while they go and play for England, play for Australia. And it's quite nice that player then comes and gives something back. Yeah. And I actually think with Ponty, I mean, as you say, I think we're both, you know, Ponting fans. It's great that a lot of Aussie fans are going to get the chance to watch him for a few more years.
We have had some Test cricket going on recently.
We have,
it's been a bit
but
disappointing.
You know what? Sadly, it's continued the sort of trend of this year, which we mostly have South Africa to thank. for, which is that it's all been very one-sided. And I was particularly disappointed with the first test between South Africa and Pakistan. Sad thing about this game is it started so promisingly. Pakistan bowled really well first innings, kept South Africa to just over 250. You thought going to the second day, you thought this is really well poised. Yeah. Really well poised. I had this real hope because Pakistan's batting lineup is actually full of quite a few players, particularly sort of Azhar Ali, Yunus Khan, Misbah Haq, who are intelligent defensive players. I mean,
well, they're proper test players.
I think that's the right way of putting it. They're the kind of players who you would back to hang around.
Yeah, which is why it was such a surprise when
they got knocked over 49. And the tragedy of this really is that Test cricket is about a sustained battle over days. It's about ebbs and flows. And in this game, like all of the New Zealand games, well, I think the two New Zealand games actually, they were over within a day in a session. I mean, everything after that was just a victory procession. Worth giving some credit to South Africa, they're becoming brutally dominant and effective in a way the Aussies were when they were world. Yeah. I mean, they're dispatching teams with disdain within a couple of days. It's just not that great to watch.
It'll be interesting to see how this, how far that dictates the way that the series develops. Mm. Because quite often when a team gets absolutely annihilated in a first test, there's really sort of no way back.
Yeah. The issue I have is, go and look at the highlights from this game if you can. South Africa do bowl very, very well indeed from what I've seen of the highlights. The only issue is, I just do not feel it's acceptable to be dismissed for 49 as a test team. I mean, South Africa bowl well, but they ultimately get there because of some poor shot choices and poor shot selection. And I really hope Pakistan learn from that. Yep. You've been upset by a development in, test cricket's prodigal son, perhaps?
Yeah, I suppose it's a pretty apt metaphor. The Zimbabweans are about to tour the West Indies. And they have announced that due to financial restrictions, they will not be taking with them as many of their backroom staff as they normally would. And they're leaving behind Grant Flower, their batting coach, brother of Andy, obviously. Heath Streak, who's their bowling coach, both Grant Flower and Heath Streak being great Zimbabwean cricketers of the past. And then Lorraine Chivandra, who is the fitness trainer. I've always been one of those people who sort of thought that any team cannot be taken seriously if they have more than a coach.
Mm.
But it seems in this circumstance that Zimbabwe are giving themselves no chance whatsoever to actually succeed in international cricket. If they're not willing to sort of... Yes, it's an investment to have a full staff that goes away, but actually how much is actually going to cost to send three extra people to the West Indies for a few weeks is going to be pretty minimal. But it seems as if they're actually at the stage where they sort of need to invest in order to get anything back. And if they keep on cutting away grassroots cricket, cutting away their coaching facility, they're just never going to develop. And in a sense, you know, it's a pretty hopeless situation, as was summed up when Brendan Taylor, the captain, went on to Facebook, which is a bit 20th century, really. Should have been on Twitter, but went on to Facebook and publicly said that he wasn't happy about this.
Well, I think this West Indies tour is a great opportunity for this young side, and it's just a shame they're not making the most of it. I really feel for Brendan Taylor, who, if you look at his stats, look at his performance, he does incredibly well against very good players again and again and again. And I just feel like they had a great opportunity to make something of this series, to move on, and Zimbabwe's cricket board have squandered it.
So, from the archives, and now in 2013, it seems far-fetched to imagine a world devoid of 2020 cricket, but look back just 7 or 8 years, and that's where we were. And Andy's done some quite interesting work looking at a 2020 championship from 2005 that's passed us by a little bit.
Well, it's funny, the idea of a competition that happened in 2005 that we'd entirely kind of ignored and missed seemed quite odd.
There was nothing else happening in the cricket world in 2005.
Well, that is true, yeah. The International 2020 Championship was the first ever attempt at a global T20 Championship. It was driven primarily by a group of Indian investors called Investors in Cricket, who were working quite closely with Leicestershire at the time. And the idea was to create a cricketing tournament based on football's very, very successful Champions League. So the winner of every domestic T20 championship in the world would compete to be the winners of the International 2020 Championship. The initial competitors of this first ever tournament in 2005 were the Somerset Sabres, who'd won the English 2020, Leicester Foxes, who were there as the runners-up, but also, I guess, the hosts, Chillaw Marians, who were the winners of the Sri Lanka 2020, Faizabad Wolves, winners of the Pakistan 2020, Nashua Titans, who'd won the South African 2020, and oddly, the PCA Masters 11, Professional Cricketers Association Masters 11, who were there to make up the numbers, really.
There are two really interesting things about the setup at this stage when you go back to the really early days. Firstly, the countries that are missing teams. And secondly, the fact that you do have quite a sort of English county bent. You know, you have this World 2020 tournament happening at Grace Road in Leicestershire, whereas now obviously it's happening in the IPL in India. And the fact that when it was started up, that there was this kind of the big world championship was something that was still sort of dominating.
You make an interesting point, because England got there first with 2020. We were the first country. So in that sense, it makes total sense that we were the first country to host this. But you're quite right that since, we've lost all control over the sort of global big competition.
And over the money as well.
Inevitably over the money as well. Sadly, in terms of big names, the competition suffered a few early blows. So a host of the Nashua Titans top players chose to play in Jack Callis's benefit match instead, which seemed like a bit of a shame. I mean, great for Jack Callis. And quite a few of the Chillaw Marians top players were playing for Sri Lanka in a test series in Pakistan. the format involved two groups of three, with the top two to progress in each group. Group games on the Thursday, Friday, semi-finals and final on the Saturday. I really don't like these sort of very generous groups where everyone by one team gets through, but whatever. The one thing that I think is quite cool actually about this as a format is getting a whole tournament done in 3 days. And given that we moan so much about, you know, over-scheduling and all this stuff.
One-day World Cups that go on for a month and a half.
That being the classic example where you get sick of the tournament and lose track of it by about halfway through. This does have a certain appeal. However, things did not start well. Anyone who came to Grace Road on the Thursday expecting to see three different 2020 games would have seen a total of 2.1 overs. This is what happens if you schedule a tournament in England in September. They would, however, have witnessed the oddity of three bowl-outs in the luxurious setting of the indoor cricket school. Bowl-outs are kind of odd. They're written into cricket's rules but don't happen very often. Having three of them back-to-back, particularly in, I'm sure it's a lovely place, but Leicestershire's indoor cricket school, must have been a fairly miserable start, kind of anticlimactic start to this tournament.
Just very briefly, a very, very quick anecdote, completely off topic, but I was once watching a bowler involving Harbhajan Singh, and I was very interested to see the fact that he was one of the bowlers bowling, to see the fact that he still pitched it half a foot outside off stump and turned it. He didn't bowl it straight.
He presumably missed the stumps.
No, he hit the stumps. But that his default ball for hitting the stumps was to turn it rather than just to bowl it straight. But anyway, that's completely
It does lead me onto an interesting subplot with these bowlers, whereby the PCA Masters, who were frankly full of quite a few veterans who'd had their day, I mean, some very good actual modern cricketers, you know, young cricketers as well, but a couple of veterans, they won both their bowl-outs on that day against sides who would probably have expected to beat them, so it actually got them through to the semi-finals. The Friday improved somewhat. It didn't rain. They got all the games in, and as a result, the teams that progressed through to the semis on the Saturday were the Chillaw Marians, the Faizabad Wolves, Leicestershire, and the PCA Masters, courtesy of their two wins in the bowl-outs. However, this wasn't great cricket. Three very one-sided games. So by this point, after a day of rain and a day of one-sided games, the International 2020 Championship isn't really kicking off. On the Saturday, things do get a lot better. There are two great semi-finals. Faizabad Wolves secure a three-wicket win over the PCA Masters with a boundary off the last ball of the game. Oddly enough, this is Phil de Freitas' final game. So for a guy who's won the Ashes for England, this is a rather odd place to end your cricket career in the International 2020 Championship. Chris Gayle also involved, taking 3 for 13 for the PCA Masters. And somewhat appropriate that a guy who's become the ultimate superstar of 2020 was involved at this early stage, I think. In the other semi-final, the Chillaw Marians scraped to 112 off 20 overs, but still managed to beat the host, Leicestershire, by 9 runs. So by the Saturday, as you can see, things have improved. We've at least had two close semi-finals. In the final, which was an all-Asian affair, as you can tell, Faizabad versus Chillaw, Faizabad compete a relatively comfortable victory. 5-wicket win with 2 overs to spare. And the end result of this, as you all know, is that the International 2020 Championship was never repeated. 4 years after this, the Champions League 2020 has begun, and even though it's nowhere near had the sort of success or appeal of the IPL, it certainly kind of filled this niche,
It would be really interesting to know what the kind of, and I'm sure there are people who have written about this, but what the kind of atmosphere was around this tournament, whether there was a sense that something new and exciting was on the horizon that was going to sweep the world, or whether it was just a fairly dreary sort of short overs format that was interrupted by rain in September because no one else had any other cricket.
Actually, all the writing I've read on this has been very perceptive in that they say again and again the same things the journalists write about it, say, this is a really promising idea, it makes a lot of sense, but we don't think this is going to work. That was the general idea. And I think, actually, if you look at why it didn't work, there are a few key reasons. I think the lack of superstars is a really big reason. And there's an interesting quote here from the founder, who said, "We believe the format makes stars of the players, not the other way around." And you can kind of debate this for days and days and days. But I think what the IPL has shown is that, yes, the IPL can make stars of players, but the IPL's initial success was reliant on having lots of stars.
That's how the auctions work. It's people with ready-made reputations who, on the whole occasion, you get someone who gets picked up for a ridiculous sum and has never played cricket before. But it's exactly the way the hype works around it.
And I think the tournament, there was a naivety amongst the organisers if they didn't believe, you know, superstars are the draw. The superstars are what, even I'm not a great fan of the IPL, but occasionally I can't resist watching it and watching those great players. Amongst the other issues, there's just a sense that maybe it was ahead of its time. You know, Toby made the point, several countries, West Indies, Australia, India, didn't have representatives. It meant that globally, there's not much of a fan base. You know, you've taken away an awful lot of the fans, potentially. I also wonder if you look at the IPL, it's so reliant on getting TV on side, you know, getting TV coverage. And the International 2020 Championship didn't quite master that. The only place the game were actually shown live was in South Africa. Everywhere else just had highlights packages.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the sort of lesson that seems to be able to be drawn from this is that you have the game in its purest form, which is, you know, 20 overs per side, you go out and you see how many runs you can score and you come back in. But actually, that is not what is at the heart of its success. So you do it in England, you do it in the rain, you do it without superstars, and it doesn't really work. You take it to India, you put billions of pounds behind it, and you get the world superstars to endorse it, and suddenly it becomes.
And I think you hit upon probably the key point there, which was that this competition was put together by people who, let's give them credit, I think they had a great idea. You know, I think they had a great entrepreneurial sense, but they simply didn't have the finances to really commit to it. And I think there's a really telling fact here that the total prize money for the winning team, £64,000. You know, in the era of the IPL, that's laughable. And I think you have to be aware of the fact that what made the IPL work maybe wasn't, you know, a genius, precise idea. It was an ability to throw seemingly endless cash at players. To the review, and this episode, for the first ever time on this podcast, we're reviewing a work of fiction, Chinaman by Shihan Karuna Tilaka. This book tracks the quest of W.G. Karunasena, a Sri Lankan journalist who, seriously ill, kind of near to death, who is spending his final months of his life desperately tracking an almost mythical cricketer, Pradeep S. Mathew, who Karunasena saw when he was younger, a great spin bowler, and he's desperately trying to find him and write his biography.
I think it's worth saying to kick off that I started reading this a Sunday or two ago, and I sat down and I read probably 70 or 80 pages of it, and I sent a text to Andy and I said, "This is absolutely bloody amazing."
Yeah.
And he replied and said, "Yeah, it really is. I've just done exactly the same. Sat down and read 80 pages." I mean, it's not. I haven't finished it, but through lack of time rather than anything else. And it is one of the most readable books I've ever read, cricket books or not. And actually, therein lies quite an interesting point. Where does it sit? Is it a cricket book? Is it a novel? What would you get out of it if you weren't a cricket fan? I personally actually think that it has a really strong narrative to it. It has a lot of interest that's not cricket, but you do really need to be able to be picking up and have the kind of the fluency in the language that he uses.
The test of this is, that I've kind of applied to myself, is would I recommend this book to a non-cricket fan? And my answer would absolutely be yes, but I feel like you get more out of it, perhaps, from a cricket fan's perspective. This book says an awful lot to a cricket fan about why we care about cricket, why we care about the game. And that, it speaks to a cricket fan there in a way that maybe it wouldn't speak to a non-cricket fan.
There are sort of references to both experiences. For instance, when the book keeps on coming back to when Sri Lanka won the World Cup in the mid-1990s. And the experience of when the author is sitting in a bar next to a sweaty, topless hirsute, a taxi driver in a pretty seedy bar in Sri Lanka, and they're kind of, you know, and they hug each other when they're, and just the description of it is absolutely, I mean, anyone who's a sporting fan will know that. But also there's a wonderful description of a post-match interview between the hero, who the narrator is spending the last years of his life chasing, and this Yorkshireman, who must be Geoffrey Boycott. I mean, this is the other thing, that the book perpetually teases you with things that actually did happen, and things that are actually liable. I did actually go onto Quick Info and look up.
It's incredibly playful, isn't it? Because it plays around with true events and fictional events and kind of interweaves to a point where you're quite right. You're left working, you're trying to wonder, is this true? Is this not? Was this match fixed? Was it not? You know, all this sort of stuff. Ultimately, it's a book about outsiders, two outsiders. Karuna Sena is an alcoholic who's become alienated from his wife, from his son, who finds himself at the end of his life kind of desperate. Desperate to complete this quest to find Pradeep Mathew, almost to give meaning to his life, and it adds a kind of element of sort of tragedy to the whole thing. And Pradeep Mathew as well is this cricketer who had incredible talent but never fitted in, never really kind of fitted in within the Sri Lankan hierarchy. And you sort of wonder, well, did you need to make up a fictional cricketer? Couldn't you have found a real cricketer and just written a book about him? But in a way, Pradeep Mathew, What Karuna Tilaka has created here is the kind of dream cricketer in a lot of people's heads. Well, this guy who can bowl deliveries that no real cricketer could.
Well, there's this wonderful description of he can bowl both. Pradeep Mathews can bowl both left-handed and right-handed. And there's Sri Lanka are playing a test series against Pakistan, a series that did actually exist. And Sri Lanka are warming up in the nets before the match, and Pradeep Mathews impersonates every single one of the Pakistani bowlers and does them all as well as the bowlers themselves could do. And I think the wonderful thing, you say, did he have to make up a character to be that? And I think, yes, absolutely he did, because I think the point about this Pradeep Mathews character, I have to here say that I haven't finished the book.
I'm not spoiling the ending.
And you're not going to spoil it for me or for anyone else. But this cricketer who is always sort of glimpsed in memory through other people's stories, and who is this completely changeable character. He can bat like anyone. He can bowl like anyone. And in a sense, I think it's a really effective way of looking at the way that we all interact with different characters, and necessarily he's fictional because of that.
Well, it's also a book very much about the art of writing, because the whole book is about, it's about how he gets this biography written or attempts to write, and it becomes this quest. You know, he ends up visiting anyone from sort of ex-coaches to sort of gangsters to match fixers to all sorts of people to try and get this book fixed. And you realise how actually what... and I mean, we review biographies on this show the entire time, and you realise that in a way, to write a biography requires becoming completely obsessed with someone else's life. And part of you will think, well, why would you ever bother doing that? You know, frankly, do your own life.
To the extent that the narrator ends up dreaming about, you know,
constantly
being in the
constantly hallucinating about him.
So, I mean, I can't recommend this book highly enough, and I think if you haven't read it, it's one that I think almost anyone will enjoy. Both teams spent the second half kicking the ball around and refusing to attack. flabbergasted. The crowd jeered. Algerians in the stadium began burning German flags and waving money at the players. It was a farce of a match, but it was also perversely compelling. The same fascination that makes me stare at road accidents and peek at my hanky after blowing my nose. That's the narrator in Chihan Koenitalaka's Chinaman talking about his favourite ever football match that involved Austria and West Germany conspiring to allow Austria to win 1-0 and therefore to progress to the next stages of the World Cup. As England's women employ similar tactics, we ask whether it's within the bounds of sportsmanship.
So the context for this is that early this week, the West Indies women played England's women, and West Indies were dismissed very cheaply for just over 100. England then, in their run chase, intentionally, or at least this is how it's been very clearly depicted by both the media, the team obviously have been kind of less explicit about this, intentionally scored their run slowly so that they wouldn't damage the West Indies' net run rate too much. The reason for this was that if West Indies progressed rather than Sri Lanka progressing, England would have a slightly better record in the Super Sixes. So there's the logic, there's the rationale. It's a really difficult point, this, and I think for once in a debate, Toby and I are kind of quite undecided, and you're not going to see us on the kind of pro and anti side that we normally are. It's not match fixing, obviously. England still wanted to win the game, and they were in such a good position that they could kind of win the game how they wanted. Nevertheless, there's something a little bit uncomfortable about a team consciously trying to score slowly, in that sense, not perhaps quite do their best, and also trying to eliminate another team, you know, trying very specifically to target and eliminate another
team. But, I mean, in a sense, that's the point of playing in a tournament.
Mm.
You play in a tournament because you're sort of playing the long game, as it were, aren't you? We saw it in the Olympics over the summer with the, I think it was the Chinese badminton team,
yeah,
wasn't it? Who conspired to lose so that they could play against easy opposition.
They did get in trouble, didn't they?
Later. They got expelled from the tournament. So there's firstly,
so that's an interesting example to use to try and justify the England women's team ahead.
So that's the ethical point. I mean, the other thing that, Koenitalaka, the point he's making is that actually it can add a completely new dimension to the game. Whether it's a welcome dimension or not is another question. But it's actually it's kind of a challenge. It's a new dimension to the whole thing. Whether sport needs that new dimension of sort of aiming to win with only two balls to spare, for instance.
Well, this is the interesting thing about it. It's strategic, isn't it? It is clever. And actually, frankly, I thought it was really clever, actually. Because I don't know if in that position I would have thought that far ahead, because it's actually quite a complex calculation they've made, because, you know, this is all quite tedious admin stuff, but once you're in the Super Six stage, it's your record against the other teams that you've already played who then qualify. So having lost to Sri Lanka, England didn't want Sri Lanka to qualify. But it's quite a clever calculation to make. I just think it's this... Okay, put it on its side and imagine that this was the England side who were eliminated as a result of behaviour like this. I know there'd be outcry. I know there'd be outrage over this. Whether that's right or not...
There would, but only from the Daily Mail, who will...
No. It's not just the Daily Mail. There would be a lot of cricket writers who would, cricket fans, who would not feel it quite appropriate.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I see your point. The tricky thing is, I keep on coming back to the fact that when you... I mean, you were talking about, in the introduction to the podcast, Shane Warne was talking about rotating players. That's another thing that you have to do in tournaments. The whole point about a tournament is you have to plot your route from beginning to end. And just as within a game, you might say, we're going to take our power play at this point and try and score loads of runs here, and then we're going to try and batten down the hatches and not lose any wickets here. That actually, it's quite a... It's an effect, and the fact that you have to be sort of... I'm not saying that if something's clever, therefore it's right, because lot of match fixing would go straight to heaven. But I think there is something to be said for the fact that it's playing the long game.
I think the other thing that is a fair point to say, that they were still trying to win the game, and that's obviously that's what sets it vastly apart from something like match fixing. I also think the idea of scoring slowly, intentionally, isn't actually anything new. I mean, within a test match context, there will be situations where it will make sense to do that, and we wouldn't necessarily criticise it. I just think it was one of those areas that perhaps, because it struck a lot of people as a surprise. I mean, I actually was listening to some of this game on Radio 5, and I felt like the commentators didn't quite know what to say. You know, they weren't quite sure, is this okay? You know, should we condemn it? Should we not?
I think another important question is actually what it does to how the game is perceived, in the sense that if you go along to a game where someone's trying to score slowly, it damages the reputation of the game in the eyes of the public. I mean, the big time when cricket scored slowly was when Len Hutton was captaining England in the 50s, when his tactic, built off the fact that he was a batsman who was an absolute expert in basically just stonewalling, his tactic was you bat until you can't lose the game and then you try and win it. And it resulted in some of the most boring cricket that has ever appeared.
It's worth adding, by the way, as a very important caveat to this, is that England's strategy didn't work, in that Sri Lanka then hammered India in the later match, which then meant they went through. And actually, incidentally, the West Indies went through as well. So everyone ended up happy. So it's almost more like a kind of theoretical point here. I just think it kind of does come with the issues. I mean, you made a very good point. You know, spectators who come to the game, when they find themselves watching a team intentionally scoring slowly, I mean, what kind of a spectacle is that?
I think another thing is this question of, we have this idea of the spirit of cricket, which is in some senses different to the law of cricket. But actually, the umpires can step in and can adjudicate for anything that they see is against the spirit of cricket.
Right.
But this is impossible to adjudicate against in any sense whatsoever.
It's not that they're not trying their best. They're trying their best to achieve a very specific outcome, a kind of very different outcome. I wonder, by the way, again, it's sort of going down a slightly admin, technocratic route here, whether the real problem to blame here isn't the fact that net run rate is being used to decide which team goes through. I mean, that's just a slight personal bugbear of mine, where I just don't necessarily know if that's the best way of doing it. And you've actually created quite a perverse incentive there.
Yeah.
Because as a result, you know, this scenario has been entirely created because net run rate's become the determinant. That's an alternative.
I think the other issue will just be how and when this can come to an end. In the sense that how far can teams take this before it starts becoming a problem?
Yeah.
And that's the real problem with sort of...
You're quite right that this may well establish an interesting precedent as well. I mean, how many teams may well in the future then think about it, and once it actually ends up eliminating a team from a tournament, then it becomes a big issue.
Exactly. Thanks for joining us again on Reverse Web Radio. I think the conclusion of today's episode is that there can be no better way to spend a day than to sit in Dharamsala Cricket Ground reading Karuna Tilaka's Chinaman.